time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly, and I'm here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
Tonight, we're going to talk about the finale, the 10th episode of the second season of HBO's The Leftovers.
Man, so bittersweet, friend.
This one is called I Live Here Now. Before we dive into the episode, I'm going to start with something a little off the beaten track for us. Listener Michael has written in with a little research on cocaine for us. Last week, we were wondering if it was a real representation of whether or not Meg would need to go and double dip into her cocaine supply so quickly.
I admit, I am not very good at my coke ABCs. I just don't know how often you should be sniffing that biz up your nose.
And Michael, who, by the way, also starred as the bartender in the Honky Tonk in the Meg episode.
I love it. So he's actually an actor from the show. So he was on screen there. Did he talk?
I think he just served.
He served up the shots there.
Yes.
I love it. So I love that he reached out to us and said, hey, I have some answers for you about that coke situation, which is like, I'm just saying, I'm sure Michael himself does not, right?
No.
He has a friend.
He asked his friend.
I'm sure.
Michael's not admitting to any sort of
wrongdoing.
Definitely
not. And we're not even
implying.
And we're not
insinuating that Michael's
done
anything.
I'm sure.
The point is, cocaine is addictive. The user would, in his friend's opinion, have no problem going back as often as necessary until the coke supply was gone, or until their money was gone, or both. So, yeah, Meg going back just as rapidly as possible, that's on the money for an addicted coke user.
That is wild. That's so wild to me. How exhausting that must be to have to keep going back.
I guess that's why you take the stimulant, is to keep up with the
I guess you do have some extra energy. Did you note, Paul, too, that she was not in the women's room doing the coke? She was actually in the men's room.
Did you see urinals or something? I didn't.
It was confirmed. It was the men's room.
Wow.
Right? Mm. Hey, I guess if you don't want to accidentally run into your mom, go to the men's room, right? And plus, I mean, Meg's a good looking woman. I figure if some guy comes in there and sees her in there, he's probably like, oh, hey, like, what's going on in here? But if a woman would be like, oh, I never, you know?
Right.
Like, I kind of think men would give her a pass and women would be a little more judgy.
It's like when we went to Wizard World and there was that girl dressed up as Han Solo in the men's room helping her boyfriend who was dressed up like Chewbacca. No one complained.
No one even cared. Right. Everyone was like, welcome. Welcome, woman. Come on in.
Anyway, we're drifting now.
A little bit.
So let's start talking about the episode.
So what was your overall vibe? Were you satisfied as a viewer, or did it leave you wanting more? How'd you feel?
Oh, no, I am not left where I'm like, oh, now I'm all done with The Leftovers. That left me with no questions. But as far as a second season finale, yes, I thought it was done super well. I was not left wanting at all.
I agree. I felt like they did a wonderful job of touching on all of our characters. They did answer some questions. They did tie up some things for us.
The major plot mystery of the second
absolutely.
Season.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, obviously. Evie, certainly that was tied up. But at the same time, I feel like there were parts that were still a little unknown. And one thing I'd like to say about the concept of there still being more questions, and I know there's a lot of people who kind of say, they'll tell us one thing, but then we still have other questions. That's life, baby. Like, who in the world at any given time could you like stop someone and be like, do you know every answer to everything that's going on in your life and your neighbor's life and everything? You'd be like, no, of course not. There's every single day you get some answers and there's new things that crop up, you know? That's kind of why like we all have to-do lists and whatnot. You get some things done and there's some things still left to be accomplished.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of silly to be like, oh, I don't like it when shows leave extra questions. Like,
well, the
show is super realistic.
The articles that I've read that have said that what Damon did with Lost, he kind of got correct this time around with The Leftovers. And I kind of agree with that, where Lost, he would answer a question with 10 more questions. He managed to narrow it down to a manageable level. where people feel more satisfied with their answers this time around, I think.
And honestly, I also feel like with Lost, I have not done a ton of watching network TV versus, what do you call it, HBO?
Pay cable.
Okay. I can say that I see a distinct difference in the way that shows are made. And we recently got to go to a television festival. And that was the first time when I really started to understand the boundaries, the parameters, the restrictions, the way you have to write scenes so that you have like cutaways to commercials and all this kind of stuff. I really never thought about why one type of show looks one way and then an HBO show looks different. And I can say, I think that Damon's storytelling absolutely lends itself to the HBO world. If Lost had been on HBO, I think it would have been a completely different story. I think those questions would have felt completely different if you weren't constantly cutting away to whatever the advertisement of the week was.
Dun, dun.
Exactly. If you didn't have that nonstop cliffhanger feeling, I don't think the viewers would feel as jerked around as a lot of people complain to be, you know?
Yeah.
I think it was the coming and the going. If you sat and got to watch for a full 60 minutes, I really think you would have felt more satisfied, because when we watch the DVDs, I feel less, you know, like we came in and out of the story over and over. So I think it's fascinating. I'm super glad that Damon found an opportunity to be on an HBO cable pay channel, because I think that this is the way to go.
And we'll see him next year.
So, okay, let's get right into this episode. We started right back at
the
John's
birthday
party, right?
From the first episode.
Back to We Have No Friends birthday party, which kind of turns out that they didn't really have a lot of friends. We thought that was a completely dry joke on John's part. And as it turns out, John does not have a lot of friends.
He has people that are scared of him.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you that. Why do they have such deference to John? What's the deal with that? Why do the Rangers? Why do the townspeople? What is the story there? I mean, is the local fire chief got it? But I mean, he's been to jail. He's not exactly like Mr. Perfect. What is the deal?
I could see it where if the people giving him that deference thought that he went to jail for a kind of a noble reason.
Okay.
The attempted murder of Virgil was right. I mean, you're from the South long enough to be aware of the needed killing defense.
Right. Absolutely. That's very true. That's very true. I mean, there's sort of like, and for those of you who maybe are not from our neck of the woods, I would say that there's also sort of cowboys or outlaws. There's kind of like a very thin line of sort of like, sometimes you can use force for the good, I guess, is what I want to say. And not being like necessarily, I mean, vigilante kind of stuff is kind of how the South was at one point, or if you want to say the West, if you will. Sometimes the sheriff had to do what he had to do.
Basically.
And everybody did have to kind of fall in line.
That gets you fear and respect, but not necessarily birthday party friends.
You're right. I don't feel like in any of the movies we ever saw John Wayne like blow out birthday candles, right?
No, right.
I mean, you know, even though he was a good guy, you know.
If you're younger than 25, John Wayne was a big-time actor a long time ago. It's a shame you don't know who he is.
Oh, that's sad.
So we get to reenact the girls pulling up to the front of the house, and this time we know what we're in store for when we see Evie get into the car. Make a point of seeing Evie hand her dad the little box for his birthday present, the best present ever, she says. Once Evie's inside the car, though, they turn into freakout mode again, and they all go silent, and they turn the radio down because they've been pretending to be normal.
Right, and Paula had, like, thrown this out to me, and I cannot for the life of me remember if this was recorded or not, but he had said, you know, I really feel like when they're acting so silly and they're acting so brash and flirting with Dr. Goodhart and just kind of being so mouthy and everything, that feels to me like it's a put-on. When they got in the car and they were silent, it seemed like that was more real. So, man, hats off to you, Paul. You were totally right. When they went silent, especially when the driver starts like quietly weeping, didn't it feel like, wow, are you John Jr. in the back seat there, Evie? I mean, did it not feel like she was so freaking intimidating?
Right. It did make me wonder if the driver was as in it as Evie was.
You know,
she was the one hugging onto her legs.
She was. When they found him in the Airstream, she was the one like acting so weird, hugging on Evie's. That was so odd.
So Evie writes on her little pad, GR style, don't. But that's all we could see in the mirror. Don't.
So they pull up. Now, here's some question marks I have on the timing here. We know that it was just getting dark, you know, pretty much. I guess it had been
the timing
dark.
Just doesn't work.
Well, curious. I'm super hoping that season three, maybe we get to back the clock up again and get some more like answers to some of this stuff. I mean, I would give it 9 o'clock because she was supposed to be home at like 11. So it can't be
that late.
They
would have had to have been gathering up maybe the other girls were in the car. So maybe if you thought maybe they came to her house completely unprepared.
Right. You'd have to start
there. And had to go back to their houses to get their stuff. And then they went to the pond.
But still, I mean, I'm telling you, when Evie puts her phone in the car, she like pushes the button so that the screen lights up. It's 2:52 in the morning. They left John's house at, like I said, she had to be home at 11. So she left there at like eight. I mean, how many hours were they planning on going out? Where were they all that time? I'm super curious. I know it's kind of like, what difference does it make? Maybe they went and had a meal. Maybe they went and like, maybe they did meet up with friends or do some. I mean, you know, maybe they went and did the things they said they were going to do. Maybe they saw a movie.
Naked running,
whatever, stretching out, whatever, right? Doing some yoga, whatevs. Maybe they had to go pick up some cigarettes.
They're getting out of the car. They're getting their stuff together, staging the scene that they want the car to be found in, the state that they want the car to be found in. Evie sees Kevin on the side of the pond with his cinder block in his hand, and she sees him looking back at her.
They just kind of stare at each other for a minute.
But Kevin just turns back to what he's doing and hops in the pond with aplomb. I mean, he just bloop.
I know. That was kind of surprising to me. I mean, I don't know what I thought that was going to look like, but I think I thought it would be a little more stumbly or something. But the way it was just like, point your toes and I'm in, you know, like, whoa. Did you think in that moment that he might say something or she might say something to him?
No. Well, I mean, we know that everything went down the way that it did. So right. I thought that that's pretty much how that was going to go down, that they just looked at each other and I mean, that she did not run over and try to assist him.
Oh, no, it's not that. I thought she might be a little teenage nasty, like a little like, what are you looking at? Like something like that, you know, something like a little like.
Well, she's a Meg disciple, so she might have that in her
soul. Oh, I totally think she has that in it. She's got that, why don't I walk over and put my cigarette out in her eye, kind of crap in her heart. All right, so Kevin jumps in, and we get to actually see the earthquake that sucks the water out.
These are what you might call some dodgy special effects.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of just someone making the camera shake.
Well, right. It's like we zoomed in on a bathtub with like the little swirl of like when it goes down the drain or something. Like, okay. But we did do a kind of a cool effect where we mashed into Kevin climbing out of the dirt.
Yeah,
so
that was pretty cool.
That was kind of a cool segue there.
Kevin's resurrection, you might say. So he crawls out of the ground. We get Michael. Holy shit, Michael.
And he, Holy Wayne and holy shit.
Yes. Kevin, having been dead for a while, needs to warm back up.
Warm up and hydrate, because he has not been drinking over in the other realm. Thank God, peeps. Listen, if anything happens to you, don't. You hear me?
Don't.
I don't care how thirsty you are.
All right.
Just don't.
Don't drink until you get back.
Figure it out. I don't know. Rub some lotion on your skin. Try to get some moisture other ways. But like, don't. Eat something that like yogurt or something that has like a lot of moisture in it.
He finds out that he's been gone for 8 hours and that he's been buried at Virgil's instruction, which Michael carried out.
Michael does ask, like, so where were you? And he said, you know, well, it was a hotel. And this part was kind of sad because this whole time I had sort of a question mark about how much Michael knew or knows.
Or even the extent of his faith in this I wouldn't say that this is very Christian stuff.
Yeah, you're right. Certainly the resurrection.
They don't teach
the hotel
at Sunday school.
No, good call. But I mean, they're kind of treating this purgatory. But you're right, it's very kind of black magic-y, voodoo-y. But here's the thing. He asks, did you see my sister? Oh,
well, at first he asks, did Virgil help you? And he's pleased to know that he did help, even though his help was a little not super awesome.
No, I mean, it was super necessary.
I mean, it's going to serve Kevin well, that's for sure.
Yeah, yep.
But you're right. Then he did want to know if he saw Evie. And that's our segue.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is like, don't you think it's like kind of I don't know, the whole departure, the whole, I don't know. So what do you think Michael thought happened? Because he was just like, yeah, she's gone. I thought he was full on in departure.
Me too.
She departed.
I thought that this whole season, but was way wrong, obviously.
So no, so then he thought she was dead. Wow. I mean, ouch, poor Michael.
Unless Michael has always thought that departure and death were the same thing.
Well, that's very true. Maybe that's true. We morph on over to the Murphy's house and...
Because...
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Well, the segue I didn't see her there, but I saw her someplace else.
And I need to talk to your father. So we head on over to John and Erica's. Erica comes in and it's clearly like first thing in the morning and she's all, you know, hey, the coffee maker's not on. And, you know, he's got his...
Well, the first time all season, John's up first. This never happens.
That's very true. So who knows what that's all about? Because they really did speak a lot about his sleeping habits. So he has his...
It's a time of change for John Murphy.
So he's got his Maddie, Fear the Walking Dead, coffee mug, oh, booze. And, you know, she's pretty quick to be like, coffee maker's still cold. What you got in your cup? You know, he kind of like pulls it back, like, whatever, mind your biz. But he's still there playing with the birthday present, kind of just fooling around with it in his hands, the box.
She's kind of had enough of him and his fooling around with the present and is like, open it already.
And what, dude, how would this go down? I mean, if our child was missing and she had given you a present and this was like the last thing you had from her that was like this sort of, I don't know, this little hopeful something that you were going to open it when she came back kind of thing. I'm sorry, but you don't know us very well out there, listeners, but Paul would have chased me around the damn room if I had grabbed that box. And I would have done the same to him. If it had been my gift and he had grabbed it, we would have gone running around the table. I would have like be like kickboxing at him. Like, there's no way either one of us, we wouldn't do that to one another, but there's no way we would take it sitting down. That's for darn sure.
Now, with Evie's conversion to the GR, I thought that this was going to be an empty box.
And I thought that was a brilliant, brilliant thought because, frankly, nothing else makes sense, including what it actually is. Because if you are going to subscribe to this GR life, and this is your last word on the matter, how are you going to actually give something when it's all supposed to be, you know, nobody cares about
anything?
There
is no family.
There's no family and there is no like belongings. You know, Meg had to give up her mother's sweater. There's no belongings. There is no gifts and like that type of stuff. So I don't know if this is a whole Meg thing, like where things have changed now. But well, I was a little disappointed because I thought your nothing was like actually right on and would have been more painful than anything else. To open that box and see nothing is like she gave you nothing for your birthday.
I think that the cricket tells more. I mean, we'll see more later in the episode about the two girls, women, Evie and Erica dealing with each other. But the fact that she gave a cricket as her last representation of her feelings toward any family member, I don't know, it seemed to speak to that she might have unfinished business with Dad, whereas she was closing the book on everybody else. But Dad still had a string left untied with Evie.
Okay, but how so? Why does the cricket represent that? I mean, to me, it seemed like she was saying, Dad, you had a problem. I solved it for you. Here you go.
Yeah, because in this time, in this period where she's been GR in her soul, supposedly, but having to put on this act so that she could kind of be like this sleeper cell in Jarden, she still had this, okay, Dad, I'll solve your problem feeling that she expressed by, you know, capturing this cricket and giving
so
it to
her.
So
do you think it was the cricket or do you think that the phone was the cricket and this was like the cover?
Well, as Erica points out, there was still a cricket in the house.
Well, there was still something making a chirping sound.
Yeah.
But was it a cricket or was it a burner phone?
The way this whole conversation devolves with the Erica doesn't believe that this is the cricket because she heard a cricket the night that they left and that she probably just went and found another cricket and stuck it in the box for him because he wouldn't let it go. And that's when he says, if you, Erica. And that's pretty much when their marriage is over, I think.
You think so? You think that was it?
Well, they still have a few times when they deal with each other, but yeah, I think so.
I think you're right. I think you're right on that. It's painful, though. And that FU is like, I think it's not only did she like take this happy moment, you know, where he was like, oh, she's my sweetie. You know, she found that cricket that was bothering me. And then Erica like broke that right down, was like, no, that's not what happened. That's not the message. The message isn't, I fixed your problem, Dad. I went out of my way. I found it. I put it in a box for you. The message was, you don't let anything go, and like nobody can move on with their lives because of you. Which, I mean, do you think that was kind of like, well, mom, way to put the mom filter on it? Like, I mean, do you think that that's what the message was?
No, I think it was like you said, I want to fix this cricket problem for you. Maybe there's two crickets, you know, maybe there is no burner phone. Who knows? But we haven't seen it. We just kind of assume it. But we do know something is making the cricket sound, and the dad assumes it's a cricket. And if she had come home that night and he had gotten this cricket present, it would have been the greatest present ever, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I think.
So you think that's it. So Erica's crap is simply Erica just pushing her agenda.
Like the rock through the window. Well, why do you think they threw a rock through the window? She never said, I bet she never told him that Nora threw the rock through the window.
Right. No, that's true.
She just let him that it was his shenanigans that caused the rock through
that's
the window.
That's very true. Very well. Yeah. Well, that is absolutely the relationship stage, end game, dying breaths that they were at. Right.
Yes.
Lot of gameplay.
Knock on the door. Rangers break up this little love fest.
I love it that the Ranger's got like his hand on his like lower back, like sort of like a la pregnant woman style. Like, John, I got some information for you. Know those prints? You know how you were just like totally just making your own watercolor handprints? Like, so we got a match, man. We got a match.
This was just so confusing to those of us that really, you know, watch the show over and over again, because we saw that those prints were manipulated.
That's the only thing that really does like kind of bug me is I am 100% on board with Damon and Tom, like creating mysteries for us and, you know, making it even a convoluted road I'm for. But one thing that he always says in the interviews is that he always wants to make it fair, meaning you do stand a chance at figuring it out if you put the time and the energy and the effort into it. Well, we really studied that moment when Kevin's hand was being faxed over. And I'm sorry, but when it was scanned in, the handprint looked entirely different.
Yeah, the glove don't fit.
It didn't. So, I mean, we really thought using like our scrutinizing skills that we had found like the little loophole, like he wasn't going to be caught.
Unless whatever powers that be also manipulated it to make the match. What do you think?
Whoa.
Yes.
That's something I hadn't thought about. So you think it's just that was the deal? They were going to make Kevin Garvey the man no matter what?
Because we needed these two to get together. They're kind of opposite sides of the same coin. That's been the whole point, the whole season, right? One sleeps in, one can't get to sleep, you know?
Yeah, they're pretty literally.
One's a policeman, one's a fireman, you know?
And they're kind of one's black, one's white, right?
Well, I didn't want to.
I'm just going literally there. I mean, for any of you lost, you know, watchers, the theme of black and white, the theme of, you know, faith
science.
Versus science. Yeah, I mean, all that stuff. That's obviously huge. So John goes ahead and says, you know, hang on one second, digs under the kitchen sink because, hey, y'all, it's Texas. So he's going to go get his firearm. Just saying. So he's packing heat, heading on over to the Garveys to make a little social call, and who answers the door but a confounding Lori Garvey. Like, who are you? And I like how he stays very friendly voiced with the women, right? He's like, oh, hey, Jill. Hey, you. What your girls been making for breakfast? Little num-nums? Well, where's your pops, you know, looking for him?
They are very sure that Kevin is going to show up. Because
they're skeptical of John, for sure. They're not going in for this. Heading on over with the Rangers just to do a little knock, knock, knock. How's everybody's morning going?
But Kevin just walks up.
Covered in dirt and with Michael.
And Kevin's cop sense doesn't even stray. He's like, Prince match?
He's like, reckoning day? Yeah, that's what I thought. Just waiting for you to figure that all out.
Kevin would like to go talk about it inside. John's like, let's go talk about this someplace neutral.
What a weird ass thing to say. This man has grown up in Jardin his whole life, supposedly, right? Kevin's lived there like 2 days and they're going to go to someplace neutral that's other than Kevin's like front walk. Where would that be? Like, let me guess, the firehouse? Like, where are you going to go? Inexplicably, they go to a really strange place.
Kevin and John leave with the Rangers. Michael is also with Kevin, and he's had a long night.
Yeah,
but instead of acknowledging Jill in any way, he just goes home. And Jill is just kind of like, and she has no choice but to just go home too.
How awkward, right? The whole time I'm like, they're still in a relationship, right? Like 2 seconds ago, they were just talking about having sex. I'm sorry, what? Michael is, I mean, I know Michael's living in a whole nother realm, man. He's digging up bodies. He's dealing with stuff that Jill can't wrap her silly little mind around, you know?
Well, he says something very interesting to Erica, though. He says, I was at your dad's. He said, your dad's.
Right. And this whole time, we had been thinking that Virgil was John's dad.
Yes.
But no, it was definitively said that no, Virgil is Erica's dad.
But he'd like to get ready to go to church.
Of course. Where else would Michael head off to?
It is Tuesday. No, it's probably Sunday. But anyway. So over at the Garvey's house, Jill's walking upstairs because that's what Jill is in the mood for doing. An argument's brewing. So it's time to go upstairs.
Jill's like, I'm going to go to my room.
And Lori yells after her the single most ironic thing said all season. You're going to have to talk to me sometime. And Jill stops.
Man, I'm surprised she didn't actually, like, make a hole in the wooden step as she spun around. Because she's like, what's that now? Who's got to do what kind of talking? I loved it. Because when she said this as the actress, man, Margaret was all like, you don't know shit. And the way she said shit was like, that was awesome. You sold it.
Lori recognizes the silliness of what she says, but it is true. They are going to need to talk at some point. She says, I came looking for Tom. Your dad asked me to stay, but I will go if you ask me to. And Jill, in an awesome piece of on-cue crying, wipes away a tear with her little fist and says, he told us to stay. And she turns and leaves.
Poor Jill. Man, I hope if we get a season 3, I hope we, like, you know, do some service to Jill's character here, because she's basically just been jerked around. I'm completely confused about why she's not in school ever. Like, she's never gone to school. She's never.
It's October.
I don't get it. Like, you know, they've been there enough time that she, I don't know.
Well, she was a major, major thing, you know, major character in the first season. And this season, she's along for the ride.
And just kind of like always like coming down the stairs from nowhere or going back up the stairs to nowhere. Like, she doesn't ever have any plans. There's nothing she's doing.
I'm glad they've made her nice for the most part. But
if she didn't have this relationship with Michael, she legit would have nothing going on. That's like the only interaction she's having with anybody. It's a
little
weird.
I've seen where Damon has admitted that he felt like she needed more than she got, but they just didn't have the room for her.
Yeah.
Straying too far from the story.
Have more than 10 episodes. Boys, come on. Killing me with this. So, having nothing left to do, Laura decides to go take a joyride on the hospital bed. But here's the thing. I have to say, for as goofy as it was, and it was, to be like, this is the finale. We're all, like, counting the seconds. We want to, like, squeeze every morsel out of this episode. So, to have to spend any amount of time with her being like, like going, laying down in the bed, coming back up in the bed. But here's the only thing I have to say.
Could you picture like
that.
Mimi Leader, like off stage? Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. Like, no. Okay, down, 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 down. No, up.
Like. Yeah, actually, I can completely see that. Mimi Leader looks so much like my mom. It's like Crazyville for me. And so, like, when I met her, like, at the premiere, she was like so cute. And she reminded me so much of my mom, like, standing next to her. I was like, oh my God, you're like my mother incarnate here. I could see her doing that. But here's the only thing that I have to say. And I know it's like, okay, find symbolism in everything. Why don't you? It was what was going on with Lori. She was down. She was up. She's been down. She's been up. Like that, I mean, as silly as it sounds, she's writing a book. It's almost there. She's at the publisher. It all goes to shit. You know, she gets Tom back. She finds her. Inexplicably, they find each other on the side of the, you know, the lake there or whatever. and they're together and they're working together, and then that all falls apart.
And he calls her out for running people over.
Right. That time told tale of when you finally confront your mother for running people over, right? It's like a, you know, it's a fable we can all relate to, really.
Three Billy Goats Gruff. Exactly. Your mom runs people over.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. But so, I mean, I kind of get it. I mean, for as much as like Lori can be there to try to help physically in the last 24 hours, wherever Kevin has been, I assume she's just been like watching TV or something. I don't know what she's been doing.
Not talking to Jill.
And I don't know what's been going on, really. But I did get the concept of like the down up, down up, down up, you know. She can't just get even keeled here.
Speaking of living the dream, Nora is back in Matt and Mary's shack.
The crap shack, we like to call it.
Wearing a baby Bjorn, trying to deal with a baby she needs to feed and probably change, and an adult human that she needs to feed and probably change at the same time, all by herself.
This is such a daunting task. I can't even imagine. So she kind of decides to kind of lighten the mood here a little bit and turn on the radio. And of course, it starts playing this song that
Let the Love Flow.
Matt's been trying to use to wake up Mary, right? And she's like, hells no to that. Like, she turns that right off. And she starts listening to a radio show. And of course, I knew it was going to be October 14th, but this actually kind of was the first time I was kind of getting back into the mood of this is October 14th. You guys, this is departure day, you know, because we have the it's a radio talk show, and you have the host trying to counsel a husband through the fact that his wife has left. And the reason why she's left is because he wanted to have another baby. And, you know, she just couldn't even consider that. And the host is trying to be like, you know, she's broken. Another baby's not going to fix that. Nora, of course, takes this like completely personally and smashes the boombox to the floor and yells, fix that, Jesus, right? The radio host tries to imply that really just Jesus could have fixed this whole situation. So clearly we know where Nora stands on that idea. But here's the thing. Before this point in this whole episode, my head was not in the game for October 14th. My head really wasn't there. I was really thinking.
Well, it was just a year ago at Heroes Day in the first season where everything went nuts at the unveiling of the statue in Mapleton, where the Guilty Remnant came out with the stop wasting your breath, you know, signage.
Right.
That was just a year ago. So people's feelings are still that fresh
in,
you know, everywhere else in the listening radius.
No, but my mind at the beginning of this episode, when they started off and we're at John's birthday party and stuff, I'm not thinking anything about departure day and when it's coming and stuff. So it's really that radio show host and that really, it like brought me back. It like centered me back on like October 14th. Like, we're totally going to have to deal with that again.
Right after she blasphemes, an earthquake hits.
In a total mother move, she tries to shield Lily and Mary by sort of wrapping her arms around and wearing the baby Bjorn. She's kind of pushing Lily like onto Mary's head. Now, Paul has a kind of a theory about this because right after the rumbling, Mary's like,
Nora, what are you doing here?
Right. So she totally wakes up. I have a couple of things here. Now, we know episode 8. We saw that Mary was in the hotel. We definitely saw her. They definitely said it was Mary Jameson. They gave her balloons. And so I felt like, okay, we knew she was over there. We have seen earthquakes, and there's sort of this thought brewing around that, like, does an earthquake represent someone moving from one realm to the other? Maybe it's someone moving from our realm to that purgatory realm or back the other way. Now, here's the thing. I have no idea. I don't know when it happens. But in this particular case, you have this earthquake and now you have Mary. Now, Paul has another idea of like maybe what made Mary wake.
Caroline asked that I take a second look at it because I just thought it was earthquake equals supernatural happening in general in Jardin. Perhaps after an earthquake one day, Isaac became a palm reader. It just goes along with it. But Caroline mentioned that she had found some suggestion that maybe with the way that Nora was shielding Mary with Lily, that Lily, being Holy Wayne's baby, was touching Mary, might have caused some healing.
She specifically called the bridge. They kept saying this baby's going to be the bridge.
That got me thinking. I watched it over again, and it has the supernatural earthquake and then the supernatural baby, and just kind of magnifying that, the human lens, Nora, wrapping it all up, kind of making like a supernatural soup reaction. Of, you know, awesome sauce.
It's like a cone, if you will.
In a season with only 10 episodes, I can't really just buy the idea that Damon and the gang are so in love with red herring type rabbit holes like they were with Lost, that they would just spend a whole episode on the lensing of Nora just for that to be bull.
Well, you're right. I mean, wait, really, that's 10% of the entire season. And they discuss it in other episodes too. So it's kind of like, ugh. So I think you're right. I think, you know, maybe it did magnify the situation enough to bring Mary around. I don't know. But here we have Mayor. Did you expect her to come back here to be with us?
No.
Well, and you know what? Here's what I'm going to say. We have been talking this whole time about how we related quite a bit to Matt and Mary's situation as special needs caretakers. Here's my little we related to that storyline. And they kind of just took that storyline completely away from us just now. It's not like we would wish for Mary to have a problem. Not like we would wish for Matt to have to care for her, but that was kind of a part for us that we felt like, okay, they are really depicting a true story that's going on in people's homes around America, that some people are sitting there being like, wow, this is like too gross or too, this
real.
Is too, well, I don't even think they thought it was real. I thought they thought someone was exaggerating what it would be to be the caretaker, watching him like hoist her out of the tub and rub the lotions on her skin and stuff like. I think there was a percentage of the population who thought, wow, why don't you just like make this look worse? And it's like, no, dude, like they barely showed you the day. I don't want to say I'm disappointed that Mary woke up. That's way too strong. But I am somewhat hopeful that they find some ways to still represent that slice of the pie, that bit of the population that does relate to that, because there are plenty of people who take care of their elderly parents. There are plenty of people who take care of special needs children or siblings or whatever. So I'm hopeful that the storyline just doesn't completely blow away.
That's one thing. That's good. But for Mary in particular, I don't want to be jerked around now. If she's awake, let her be awake. You know what I mean? I don't want to be on this yo-yo train. Every time the ground shakes, everybody's got to stare and look at Mary to make sure that she's still awake.
Well,
that's not really fun TV watching.
Bad
news
bears. We're going to move forward here, and you're going to find out that people can bounce in and out of that hotel world. So I'm just saying, hang on to your hats. But I'm speaking really from the standpoint of like where I kind of got sucked into the show and where I felt like, in the same way that they showed sign language, in the same way that they showed a mother who had a hearing impairment, and the same way that they were showing you a slice of the pie that doesn't get depicted on TV very often, and certainly doesn't get depicted in a way where that person is not, Matt didn't use it as an excuse, in the same way that Erica doesn't use her hearing loss as, oh, we feel sorry for her. Like never was it ever depicted as less than or excuses or anything like that. It was just depicted as, this is real life. These are different walks of life and they exist, and your neighbor might be experiencing this. You just might not have opened your eyes to the variety of people that are out there. So I'm hopeful that we don't just start gelling into supernatural world in a way that sucks us away from that beautiful, real expression of what goes on in your life all around you all the time.
Well, from what I've read, the magic is what Damon brings, but the real stuff is what Tom brings, Tom Parada. And even though Mary isn't from the book, so there was no character like Mary in the book, I wouldn't be surprised if he was the one that made up Mary for the show. You know what I mean? Because Damon credits him with grounding the show back in the, what Damon calls the, well, if 2% of the people disappeared from the show for a supernatural reason, then 2% of the show should be supernatural, and the other 98% should be real. He gives Tom that responsibility for keeping it real.
Hey, I respect Tom. And here's the thing. I love Damon and I love the way that he speaks of grief and depression and all these things. The way that I described it, and we're going to touch on this later with some of the actual dialogue, I feel like this is one of the few shows where you don't see what you think the character is going to say. Scarily enough, it feels like they went into your brain and they actually have the character say what would be like the things that people deal with, honestly, only privately. You know, your greatest, deepest, gravest fears, your worries that keep you up at night. This show exposes them in a way that's not scary. It's in a way that makes me feel like I'm not alone. You know, when Matt is scurrying to pay the caretaker, that's real life. That's what I deal with every day. That's real, you know, and that makes me feel not alone. I want to maintain the realism that both Damon and Tom set forth at the very beginning. You know, you're going to meet people. I don't want to think of them as like broken or anything. I want to think of them as real. Every single person, if you have lived any amount of life at all, you've had experiences that are challenging and have changed you. And I appreciate that he shows those people. So speaking of some people who have dealt with some challenges,
we are in the reflection of a shaving mirror of one Matt Jameson down in the smelly encampment area.
He is doing such a bizarre job shaving that I was like, oh my God, is he going to like slice his neck here?
I tried to point out that he is using the cheapest of the cheap disposable razors from Bic where it only has one blade and yes, you got to just stab at your face.
That's what he was doing. I was like, oh my God, why is he like poking it at his face? Too funny. But guess what? Nora comes up behind and says, Matt.
And sees Mary smiling and calling his name.
And you know what Matt says? Is this real? Is this real? And you know, wow, what I was saying in previous episodes, the concept of real or the real deal or is this real has been said over and over again pretty much by every single character. Is this real? Is this real? And now this is it. Matt is saying, is this real? And they finally have their big jovial moment.
Well, that question of reality is legit in a world that has undergone a sudden departure. I mean,
it's legit.
If you remained, you might wonder if you were actually living in the real world anymore.
Do you know there's like people who think that? People who think that the 2% is what's left in the real world and that 98% actually went to this whatever the departed world is?
I think that's possible. I think that there might be a realm where there's an identical copy of the Earth, but just 2% there. But all the other shit's still there. Cars, houses, whatever. Just really, really empty.
So,
of people.
So what you see is like Nora's husband and two kids are like eating breakfast. Like, where'd mom go?
Right. And the husband's like, holy crap, where'd my wife go?
Yeah.
I've got to get to work.
Wig. Is that like season 5?
You know, back in the lost days.
Oh, that would have absolutely happened, right? We would have had a flash sideways.
Damon and Carlton used to have a podcast and they would get people that would write in, and throughout the whole life of the show, people would write in and ask them, are they all dead? Even though they were never all dead. That is confirmed. If you are listening to this show and you are one of those people that think that they were all dead the whole time, stop listening to our show because we won't agree on much.
Oh no.
So anyway, had this running joke on their podcast that the last season would be the zombie season.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Yeah, where they would bring
that would have been right on. They would have been on the cutting edge because they would have been like a couple years before Walking Dead and whatnot.
Well, guess who is a zombie? I mean, Kevin Garvey came, but he's a Walking Dead himself.
Oh crap.
Is he not? I mean, yeah. I didn't see Michael out there with any like blood pressure cuff or anything.
Oh crap.
Stop.
You think Kevin's dead? You
I'm just saying.
Paul Daly, you do not think Kevin is dead.
I'm just, you know, he's in need of a physical. Just a run down, work up, something.
Oh, boo hiss. I had no idea that's where this conversation was leading. I would have cut that crap off way sooner. People, I do not believe that, and I am poo-pooing that conversation. So back to our Matt, Mary embrace. Matt fumbles around with his wording enough to reveal that Mary is indeed pregnant.
Seemed like he was kind of hoping somehow in this short exchange that in the time that she was with Nora, that Nora would have brought it up by now.
I think that is so, I'm with you. That was like super weird. Like, wait, what? Weird.
But Mary, she just takes like it in stride, all, man. You know,
she's like, cool.
Yeah. Remember that time when you woke up? Yeah. That time we had sex? Sure.
She was totally cool. Like, sure. How long have I actually been asleep here? What's up? No, she was totally cool cucumber, man. Nothing.
Nora decides to give the couple some privacy to discuss, you know, the particulars.
Right, of their rendezvous.
Because Matt is adamant that she gets back into Jardin proper, where, you know, the wellspring of Juju can help her stay healthy.
Juju is good biz, man.
Nora is walking away, and a ne'er-do-well starts yelling at her, "Not your baby! That is not your baby!"
Was it you?
It was me.
Was that
I was the woman with the earring, nose ring chain.
Hold up. Did you know she had a snake tattoo?
Well, I know that's what her she was credited as, right?
Yeah, but hold up. A snake, like she's like a snake. And she's menacing a woman with a baby. Is that a little familiar?
Well, I thought that there was some callback there to the first episode of the season, given everything that this woman does.
Absolutely, right? Well, so here's the thing, folks. Again, we're in the South, and if y'all remember, Lily is a very dark-skinned little baby. So for someone to be screaming at a white woman, that's not your baby. It's like, what was your first clue, snake lady? Like, I mean, what?
Right.
Clearly, Nora had not birthed this baby. But I mean, what is your point? Like, why are you yelling that? You know, what is your angle here, lady?
Right. I mean, at the adoption agency, they were giving babies away.
Yes, they were. They could have multiple babies. So yeah. this is a not a
what
thing.
What business is it of yours?
You know what? That was New York, man. It's legal now in New York.
Right. I guess in Texas, we're still a little more protective,
right,
I guess.
Right, exactly.
Nora walks right by Tommy, and she doesn't know it because she doesn't recognize him because she's never met him.
I kind of thought Tom was kind of behind the scoreboard there. That's what I thought. But yeah, you're right. She could have made like complete eye contact and never
walks right
register.
By.
Yeah.
And Meg is lurking in the shadows.
Doing her Meg thing, man.
Right. He's like, that's your dad's girlfriend.
She sprayed me with the hose once. I like her. Ooh, Meg, you're a real weirdo.
Tommy is still trying to prove himself, even though he's seen the Airstream, he's seen the stoning, but he still, I guess, is hanging on to some piece of Meg in there, I guess. I'm not sure.
Well,
so
she's an attractive lady, Paul.
Well, that's true.
I know you don't see her like that, but...
No, not me. No. No, I don't see that.
I'm sure not.
So he just spits out, there is no family.
Well, she says something like, are you scared for your family? Because I guess Tom's kind of looking at Nora and the baby a little worriedly, I suppose. But she's like, you know, are you scared for your family?
And that's why he says, there is no family.
Right. And that's the whole, like, toe the line.
Yeah. And she says, then she gets all gross and in his face and is in his ears.
Oh,
like,
you thought that was gross? She got up in his face?
Yeah. Yeah, given...
Here's the thing. Can I just tell you that I was absolutely ready? So she kind of gets in his ear and is all like, no, Tom, family is everything. Now, here's the thing. I, honest to God, thought she was going to take his hand and put it on her belly. I honestly thought that. Because no matter if she was pregnant or not, that's just a gross, wiggity thing to do. And I really, really thought that's what she was going to do. And I swear to God, like, if you get, like, the uncut things, I swear there has to be, like, some scene where they did do that.
I think they're setting the stage for her to be pregnant.
Well, here's the thing. In real life, Liv Tyler was pregnant during the filming, during the course of all this. So could they have filmed some very real pregnant Meg belly kind of scenes? Absolutely. Absolutely. Put it in the vault.
It's at this moment that Meg decides she's going to get on her horse and go do this thing. her horse is actually an old truck, but she pulls up to the bridge guard post, chats with the guard, kind of makes fun of the guard because the guard says, well, it's the October 14th. It's a day that the families of Miracle like to just keep to themselves and reflect. And Meg's like, reflect on what? Nothing happened here.
I like the analogy she used. I thought it was kind of amazing.
It's like a temple closing on Christmas. It's not your holiday.
I kind of loved that. I thought that was actually like perfect. And the poor guard's like, I mean, like, he has no idea. I really enjoy that this is supposed to be this precious, precious town. And their security system is like just the sad gate arm.
Right. A wooden
comes down.
Broom pole.
Yes. A wooden broom hole.
So she makes some bluff about having plastic explosives and it kind of freaks out the guard and he jumps back and she floors it as much as you can floor it when you're dragging an Airstream trailer. She makes her way onto the bridge. She gets out, tosses the keys out into the wherever.
Over the side of the bridge.
And gets arrested instantly.
I mean, the point was not to not be arrested, right?
No, she was done. Her part is over. And as she's being arrested, the Airstream door flings open and three pairs of kids come stomping out.
Oh, now, Paul, that just shows your fashion sense. They were not all wearing kids. One was wearing Converse. One had those little slip-on shoes. Like little Skechers or something. But yeah, so freaking Evie and the ladies come popping out.
Taylor and Violet.
Yeah. Okay. What's weird about that is the real actress who plays Taylor is named Violet.
Hmm.
But then the other chick's name is Violet as the character. A little weird.
So we cut over to the kennel. This is the neutral ground where John has taken Kevin to talk. And the funny thing is, the park rangers don't need to be involved. It's just the two men.
Yeah, and the dogs. The dogs are gonna mind the store on this one. I thought when John said, which one is your dog? I thought this was like a hostage situation where he's gonna like grab the pooch by the scruff of the neck and be all like gun to this pooch's head. Like, you tell me, where's my daughter? Because, I mean, why would you even ask, like, which one of these is your dog? You're only asking if you want to do something bad.
Story-wise, we know that John needed to be close to the bridge. That's the only real good reason that they wind up at the kennel. It's close.
And it's isolated.
Yeah.
It is isolated.
I bet it's within running distance of the bridge.
You know what, though, too? I bet it would be sensible that it would have some sort of soundproofing, too. Because it's that those pooches were barking.
But everything else about it
doesn't make a damn bit of sense.
No, not
why
much.
They're in there, and nobody else is in there. It's a tunnel tube of just dogs.
Right, it's just one of those.
It's like one hallway.
Truck trailers of.
It is of yeah. Pooches. It's hey, would it have shocked you to hell if you just turned and shot one of the dogs? Like, now tell me where my daughter is.
Mm.
They already have shot a dog in season one, so don't say they don't go there.
No, but John. I mean, John's not a dog killer. He's a he'll shoot Virgil, but that doesn't make him a dog killer.
Right. He's a man killer, not a
he's
dog killer.
He's, an
don't
arsonist and,
he's got his limits. He's not going to kill a pooch.
Well, killing dogs is kind of a different thing than shooting people.
So now the information comes out, basically. You know, John says, you're going to tell me where my daughter is, and I'm going to give you your dog. No, really, I'm sorry, but that is a threat. That is like, you don't tell me where my daughter
Kevin
is.
Kevin just ignores it. He's just like, I'm not bargaining about dogs and daughters.
Yeah,
here.
No, he totally doesn't reveal his pooch magooch, does he?
No. He wants him to know that she staged it and I saw it.
Which, of course, you know, John's like, why? That doesn't...
Well, why tell me now? You've been here for weeks. Why tell me now? And he tries to explain the whole thing, which is hard to explain.
Very hard to explain.
But now, I mean, he's in. He's in this situation, so he's just got to go through with it. And he explains that he was at Virgil's place, and Virgil gave him some stuff to drink, and he was dead a little while.
One thing led to another, and your son buried me and dug me out, right? And I climbed out.
Yeah. John is not in a place where he is ready to hear about being resurrected from the dead.
He wants to know, why would Evie do this?
First, he doesn't believe that Kevin came back. He just believes that part of the story is bullshit, first of all. But beyond that, he does want to know, why would she do this? If she loves her mother, she loves her brother, and she loves me, why would she do this?
And Kevin tries to beg off, man. He's like, I don't know. And he's like, no, really, like, tell me. And he's like, maybe she doesn't. And John's all, doesn't what?
Love you.
Pow. Like, that was it. Way to break a man's soul there. Truly. How shocked were you when John shot Kevin? He's playing it cool, folks. He peed his pants.
I had seen that page on Twitter.
What?
I'd seen those three lines. The maybe she didn't, what, love you. I'd seen that. And I knew that he had the gun. And now that I had the context, I was like, oh my God, then that's going to set him off. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty instantaneous. I mean, it was like...
Justin Theroux's face, though, man, when he took a bullet, it was like... It was so wicked.
John so Murphy's wicked. Like, well, I don't have much more to do in here. So he steps out of the kennel.
Just in time for the ranger to come driving over and been like, John, it's Evie, follow us. And John's like, what? Like, shit, what?
So this is kind of funny because it's in slow motion, so it takes a while. But in real time, it probably took maybe 10 seconds. They say, John, it's Evie, follow us. And then in real time, 10 seconds later, they're beating him back like, John, get away, get back.
And it's hilarious. Like, follow us, get out of here. No, you're totally right. But here's the thing there. I loved the bookending move here from season one finale when it's the same exact music playing as Kevin is running up and it's the same as John is running up. And the music breaks right when Lori yells, chill, like that in Kevin's face. And in this season finale, the music breaks and John goes, Evie! It's like exactly the same, like, dun, 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 kind of feel. So the slow motion running, the music, the dad running to the daughter, the screaming of the name and everything. However, this plays out quite a bit differently, doesn't it? And Hale, both of them are GR members.
Down below in the encampment, everybody can just tell that there's a ruckus on the bridge because it's pretty unusual for an Airstream trailer to just up and stop in the middle of the bridge and then the park rangers to arrest the driver. That's unusual business to happen. Nora asks for the guy that I think was the unofficial sheriff of the encampment several episodes ago, the naked guy with the loincloth.
Cowboy.
Well, this time he's wearing some clothing, but he also has binoculars. She borrows them and is smugly satisfied to find out that she has been correct, that they did not depart.
Yeah, she's like, who is it? And she's all like, it's those three girls. Mary's all, what three girls? And everyone's like, Mary.
Right? Yeah.
Like, is that going to be like the running gag? Like Mary's like, what's departed? And everyone's like, Mary. Like, I mean, they could zoom in on her face and she's like, ding.
Meow, meow.
Exactly. Because they're going to have to catch her up on so damn much. She's like, who's this little black baby? Mary. she's never going to know anything. So anyway, boy, when I saw Matt and Nora, the siblings activate there, their faces were like, like, this is not good. I honestly thought they were going to lead up some pretty major biz here. I was a little surprised at the lack of it, to be honest, because they really seemed so strong. They were seeing it for what it was. They were there. They kind of hadn't been identified as a problem people or anything, you know. Matt climbed up on the top of his stockade area where that he had made his little makeshift home. And, you know, he was checking it all out. And I don't know.
They see that Evie's writing on a pad using one of the girls as a desk. And she writes 1 hour. And someone restarts the big scoreboard to count down from 1 hour.
And then someone yells, they're going to blow up the bridge. And everyone's like, woo, woo-hoo! Now we flip on over to the church. Because remember, Michael and Erica have been heading off to go say their prayers for departure day, right? So the Rev is given his, as we would say in Catholic land, homily. Although I guess it's just his sermon. And he is reminding them all that, hey, do you guys all remember 4 years ago when there was a giant happening? And all of us were ignorant to what was going on. And we were all in our homes. and no one knew anything was happening until we turned on our TVs or someone ran up to you in the parking lot or whatever. Meanwhile, Michael's like sitting there like, stewing.
He can't take his stewing anymore. So he gets up and asks the pastor if he can have the pulpit. And he retells the story of his mother's, where she embarrasses her kids about the water being left on in the bathroom with the twins when they were 5 years old, letting the water in the tub flood out of the bathroom and down the stairs. He insists that she gets it wrong, that they told her what happened amongst themselves as little kids, but that wasn't the truth of it, and they just kind of have been going along with the lie this entire time. The story, as Erica tells it, is that Evie turned on the water just to see what would happen.
Which kind of led us to believe a lot about Evie's personality, that she was somebody who would take things too far just to see what would happen, just to get a rise out of people. And that really led us to believe a lot about her in kind of a, maybe that's why she's acting this way. You know, maybe that's her motivation. She just likes to get a rise out of everyone. So she would behave this way with the town. She would fake her disappearance. But Michael supplies a completely different motivation.
He says that he turned on the water. He turned on the water as full and, what's the word, on as he could.
Yeah, like full blast.
Yeah.
To make a lot of noise.
To make a lot of noise because Evie was crying so much because their dad wasn't there because he was in prison for having shot Virgil. It sounds like the kids had not been told anything. They just knew that dad was gone.
It's so weird. I mean, so this presents a completely different Evie and a completely different relationship. This is no longer the five-year-old who is so precocious that she wants to turn on the water and cause all these problems, you know, and kind of laugh about it and see what's going to happen. This is instead a very, very wounded child who is sobbing so loudly that Michael has to drown out her tears with the sound of the water. I feel like the town didn't have the reaction that maybe Michael was hoping for. It seemed like maybe Michael was hoping for them to be like, oh, well, I never, Erica. And they were all just kind of like, you know, I mean, they weren't like, I mean, did you notice even anybody have a reaction to that story?
Well, I mean, that was family business that he was airing in front of the whole church.
But what was the reaction? I mean, let me ask you this. What changed because he told that story?
He was sick of the town song and the town mantra of we are spared. And he thought that by telling this story, he could stand up as an example and of someone who could admit that, no, they were not spared anything. Yes, they didn't have any departures on that day, but that doesn't mean that people haven't been pulled out of their lives.
Okay, so they were kind of, he was kind of equating John's being put in prison as like, sort of like, so then they had to go through turmoil in their family.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, but I kind of want to pat Michael on the head and say, like, dad going to prison is not the same thing as, like, you turn around to wash the dishes and turn back around and your whole family, like, is vanished with no answer. Like, you know, I mean, it's sad dad went to prison. He should probably quit with the trigger finger. But I don't know. It's not quite the same. I do feel like it cast Evie in a different light. Like, if me as a viewer, I feel like that's what I got out of the story was that, okay, wait, Evie wasn't this kid who was like trying to cause trouble. She was somebody who was very wounded.
No time to explore it much further, though, because even though their marriage is probably over, John owes it to Erica to tell her that Evie has been found, and he busts in the back of the church. Didn't say anything.
I think he was hoping that Erica...
His eyes say enough.
Yeah, well, I mean, they kind of like take out the sound. So then we see Erica running, full on running to the bridge. And while John gets totally knocked to the ground, Erica is like a Olympic...
She's like Jackie Joyner Kersee out there.
She just is like obstacle course, like Nitro, right? On like American Gladiators, right? She makes it right through.
Boy, we're making a lot of 80s references here, aren't we?
So she gets all the way to Evie, man, and Evie's got her pout face on, man. She's got her like, I am very important, mother. I'm dignified. And man, Erica is like up in her face.
They've taken out the dialogue but she is talking and signing at the same time.
Right. So we know signs. So she absolutely was signing, stop, talk to me. And she just keeps saying that, stop, talk to me. That's what she's signing. And she's trying to like get Evie to look in her eyes. And Evie kind of does like kind of a funny head bobbing, like making sure that nobody can see, you know, directly into her eyes. Which that's kind of not the thing, Eve. You're supposed to be able to look directly in her eyes and keep up this crap.
Well, you know, maybe she's a noob. She doesn't get to go to summer camp.
There's stink lines of new, like, coming off her bod. That's all I'm saying.
No response from Evie. Down below, Nora is watching the whole thing with the binoculars. And Snake Lady comes up and gets back in Nora's face with it. Not your baby!
Right. Well, this time Nora's got the perfect comeback line. Shut the F up! That's awesome. But dude, this is when I totally noted that Nora was wearing red. She's wearing this blood red shirt, right? And it looked so odd in the dirty, muddy color of the encampment. And, you know, with the GR all wearing white, this red...
Well, the GR starts to turn right now. So Nora's red shirt stands out even more because we find that the encampment is made up, not entirely, but mostly out of these Meg Branch GR members that have been wearing plain clothes. They've been hiding in the encampment and they've been waiting for a cue to change clothes into their white GR suits. And this is that time. So her red blouse stands out even more against that backdrop.
Well, and it's scary to me because I feel like her, you know, I mean, I can't not think of Star Trek and red shirts and all that kind of talk, right? About the whole idea.
You don't even wear red shirts.
Who?
You. Because you're afraid of being phasered to death.
Maybe that's it. But I thought in this moment, noticing her red shirt, I thought, oh crap. Lori's back at that freaking house with Jill. Nora's down here. Mary's woken up. Matt's taken care of here. Holy crap. She is going to die somehow.
Up above on the bridge, the timer, I mean, it's getting lower. Erica starts searching the trailer. She throws one of the girls out of the way completely. And she goes inside the trailer and she yells out, it's empty.
Yeah, she's had enough of this.
And below, the timer reaches zero and nothing happens.
She was like, if you're going to blow this bridge up, you're going to have to blow me up too. Would you do that? Would you do that, Paul? Would you, if our kid was out there, the hand on the plunger, would you? You know what? I know what we would do. We would pick our child up. We would pick our child up. And I'm telling you, we are not gigantic people, but we would have Herculean strength, because like there's no way I wouldn't leave our kid on the bridge, but I also wouldn't be like, then you're gonna have to blow me up too. Like, nah.
No, there's plan C here,
which is I grab your ass and I drag you off that bridge. And that is what we would absolutely
do. We're gonna invade your personal space here, friend.
Heck yeah. Fine, don't look me in the eye. Look the other way while I pull your arms and like drag you off this bridge, you know? That's what I would do.
Once that timer reaches zero, the flood starts. GR members move up the walkway where the park rangers have padlocked the little gate.
But that's all there is for security, is like a bike chain.
And they snap it right away.
With what? Bolt cutters that were missing when old Kev.
You think
needed
TJ
to have...
from the fire department is no. in the GR?
No, I think that Evie stole the bolt cutters and that's why they couldn't find them. At the firehouse when Kevin came along trying to get his handcuffs taken off.
That's pretty good. I'll go with that.
Thanks, Paul. Throw me a bone, why don't you?
Things are about to get pretty serious. Erica stares at Evie and says, I don't understand. Evie finally makes eye contact, pulls out her little pad of paper, and writes on it, you understand.
What's up with this? What is going on?
I know that you took it another way, but I took it having to do with what Erica admitted to Nora a couple episodes ago. Erica harbored this belief that Evie wasn't strong enough to withstand Erica leaving John. So It was kind of like this lack of faith, lack of believing in Evie, lack of something in Evie, some lack in their relationship. So where a lot of our characters have daddy issues in Damon's stories, I believe Evie has a mommy issue.
Okay.
And I think this is like a thing. I mean, I know you don't join the GR just because you and your mom disagree, but...
or else it would be full of teenage girls.
Right. Right. Well...
It would just be called the teenage girl group. And I feel like the other GR members would be like, I
hate this
kind of don't want to be here anymore. We're overrun with teenage girls.
But on the other hand, I think in Evie's case, what she was trying to tell Erica that she understood
was that this was a sham of a life. The whole thing was a sham. It was all, they weren't a happy family. This wasn't a perfect town, all that kind of stuff. Now, how Evie was going about this was like a little eye rolly, like, well, and joining the GR and blowing shit up is really going to change things. But I mean, I agree. I guess in the teenage world, if you think about it, there's a lot about having to be right and having to be authentic, you know, like, I just want to be me, like that kind of business. And so, you know what I mean? Like, adults can kind of be like, get over yourself, you know, like sometimes you have to just play the game, you know, there's kind of that. But with teenage girls, especially, are like, no, I just have to let my freak flag fly, you know?
Well, it's funny that she should make that point and then turn around in her white suit and then join the flood of white suited people as they flood into town.
There you go. See how this works?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was a teenage girl once.
I know. I saw it.
Paul and I have been together since we were, how old now? 17?
She was just 17, if you know what I mean.
Gross.
So down below, Matt sees what's going on and he's like, oh shit, now is the time. If we don't move now, this is not going to happen.
He was real pushy about, you know, we got to get married back in. And this is fair, right? I mean, you better get back in there, right?
He can't wait for baby Bjorn and...
Which, do you think
Miss Marple to pick up her carpet bag?
Do you think that's kind of crap, though?
Yeah.
That he just like completely ditches his sister.
Not terrifically cool, no.
But... And like kind of unlike Matt. Like it seems like he would have been like, grab onto Mary's like wheelchair, like jump on the back like pegs, you know, and like I'll push everybody. But it seemed weird for him to leave his other two girls there, you know?
He just takes off. The next time Nora looks up, he is too far away to even hear what happens because she is trying to deal with this bag and this baby Bjorn. And guess who shows up?
Judgy McJudgerson.
And she has one more thing to say. Not your baby. And then she runs away with the baby. Nora's like, you know what? I'll just leave the bag. And
right. I could probably come back for this bag. Seems like everyone's vacating the encampment anyway. I could probably come back in a couple hours. No
one
will even be here.
Moment of indecision did cost her a lot of distance.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Between her and the baby napper.
Right. Little Miss Know-It-All. Like, she sprinted off.
They get separated by a lot of people, and they have to make their way up a skinny sidewalk-sized path. All we have to go by is that we can still hear Lily crying. It's the only baby cry in the area.
Yeah. It turns out the encampment is not a hotbed of babies.
No, that's probably a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
So
good for babies, good for the other campers.
Right. Especially, I mean, if there's all these GR people, there's probably a lot of smoking.
So
safety.
Secondhand smoke.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of health issues, the nudity.
So we get out onto the bridge, and we find that the baby napper did not have a plan other than it was like part one, steal baby, part two, unknown, part three, happiness. So part two came, and she didn't know what to do. So she just put the baby down in the middle of the stampede and ran away.
Oh, my God.
And the shot looked almost exactly like the first episode when the cave mom looks down and sees the snake going over the baby.
Oh, yeah.
The shot is almost at that same angle.
Yeah.
Where you're looking down at the baby.
It's like danger and baby.
Yeah. Because you're seeing just a stampede of people going over the baby. It's just a matter of time until some galoot just Stomps the baby.
Did you think there was any chance they would stomp the baby?
This is the network that shows Game of Thrones. I mean, yeah, there is some chance that they will stomp a baby.
Oh my God.
Nora gets to the baby first. They do not have any problems stomping Nora, however. She gets stomped 3 or 4 times before we hear a familiar voice say, "Nora!" and a tattooed arm reach down.
I was so happy to see that it was Tom.
That was like hair-raisingly heroic, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I was so proud of him. I mean, I hope that this means that he's like officially done. Do you think he's going to sway back in? I mean, is this just like a weak moment or what?
I think he's going to be 98% in it with the Garveys, but Meg is going to be in that 2%. Just nigging at him. Mm-hmm. And if she comes back pregnant, it's going to be way hard for him to keep his head on straight.
I'm with you.
But yeah, I mean, if she's not pregnant, then it's
can I tell you that that the whole reason why I think that Kevin and Lori got together is because Lori got pregnant with Jill. I do not see any historical anything. No, there's no story I can make up in my brain. There's no nothing where I can say, oh yeah, he got down on one knee and he was madly in love with her and they got engaged and it was beautiful. Like, hells no. They were totally the couple where she was like, I'm pregnant. And he was like, I guess we gotta get married. You know, like, blech. Really, barfaroo.
I'm well aware of your dissatisfaction with their pairing.
Yeah, no, there's like zero chemistry, I'm just saying. There's zero chemistry. I didn't know Lori before, but
Tommy knows that the Airstream is a perfectly safe place to be, and that is where he decides to go with Nora and Lily.
That was really smart. I mean, nobody's going to mess with that Airstream. They can lock the door, be pretty safe in there.
Nora just knows that she's safe. She doesn't know anything about this man that has just saved her. And while they sort that out, the screen goes to white, and we're back looking at the side of an overflowing overflowing bathtub. And we're back in the hotel.
Kevin sits up clutching his heart this time, just clutching himself. He does his calf slither right out the tub. Careful to keep everything covered. Modesty first.
He sees himself in the mirror and he knows instantly where he is and what's going on. The Verdi starts to play again.
Oh, and he
lights out. It must be the theme song of the hotel.
It is. I think they must pump it through the PA, right? He looks in the mirror, Paul, and he goes, "Mother ever!" It was like, "Thank God, thank God." You're exactly feeling like we are, like, ah.
But at least he knows most of the rules of the game. He goes to the wardrobe. It's the same 4 outfits. He's like, "I am not going to be the international assassin again. That guy got his ass kicked way too many times. I'm not interested in being that guy again."
I think he realized that it wasn't him. It's supposed to be like, know yourself and adorn yourself accordingly. After he realized that it was an international assassin and all the crap that you have, I mean, it's like, okay, whoa, that's not me.
He puts on his uniform, and when the phone rings, they ask for Mr. Garvey. Now, if you remember from the International Assassin, when he puts on the International Assassin suit, the next person that talks to him asks for Mr. Harvey. That's his assumed identity.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you might assume correctly that this is his true identity, Chief Garvey. They want to let him know that even though it's out of his jurisdiction, down in the bar, there's a cop getting beat up. Can he come help? He's like, "I'll be right there."
Nice.
Yeah.
Yep. So he heads on down, and it turns out that our bridge keeper is down there leading karaoke night.
There is no cop getting beat up. No. Just old 80s classics.
Right.
Kevin recognizes the bridge guy / karaoke guy, and he's like, "I need to go back."
I liked this because I felt like they ran down the excuses of every single thing I could imagine that a person finding themselves in these shoes would say. "I don't belong here. This isn't where I'm supposed to be. All the different things."
The bridge / karaoke guy, he doesn't speak in riddles. He actually says it pretty plainly.
It's actually pretty simple this go round.
You have to sing. I mean, that is the trial.
That is it.
You have to sing. This is the test. That's all.
And Kevin says what we're all thinking. Well, this is stupid. That's all this is? Like, he just has to sing? What? It seems hard to believe. Hard to believe.
He goes up, spins the wheel, which, you know, if this was like a real karaoke thing, why would there only be like 8 songs that the whole bar would have to sing just over and over again?
That went right past me.
It's kept from us through a trick with depth of field and lenses and all that, what the song is, until it starts to play.
Right.
But it's Simon and Garfunkel, Homeward Bound.
Which I love. I love. I adore this album. And Kevin is, you know, it reminded me back at the episode when he and Matt were burying Patty, and Matt asks him to read from the Book of Job. And at first when he's reading, he's kind of a little detached, you know, just sort of going through the motions. But by halfway through, he is feeling every word. You know, it's just ripping at his soul. It scares me because it felt like a love song to the first season in such a way that made me feel like, please, please don't let this be your swan song, literally.
Well, as he's saying, there were flashes, and all the flashes came from the first season.
I know. And it scared me, though, especially things like the magazine, cigarettes and magazines, showing him jogging, smoking, and then showing, you know, the National Geographic and the trash. I was like, no, I don't want that to be over. I can't even deal with that being over, you know?
In an article I read where they were pitching the idea to Justin, not the idea, I mean, they were telling him what he had to do. They weren't pitching it. I mean, it was the done deal. Yeah, apparently his response was, awesome. You know I can't sing, right?
Well, I saw another article, and the thing that I saw that he said is that when you're acting and you're on a television show and you're just like talking to another character, that's one thing. But if your character actually has to stand on a stage at a mic in front of other characters all looking at you, I mean, that's like public speaking, which he equated completely differently than acting. On the TV show, you're just talking to your other character. Yes, you're like mic'd, but you're not at a microphone, you know? And so he was like, this was like, I have to sing at a mic in front of other people who are going to be staring at me. So he said he was super nervous. He did like 10 takes.
Oh, I bet. The way they had to cut it and stuff.
Yeah. I cannot imagine. They said he had 4 days to learn the song. I think that's weird because I felt like he was reading it off the thing. So I thought he did an amazing job. I felt so emotional listening to it. I have listened to it 1,000 times over. I've been harassing our children, making them sing different parts.
This is true.
We have an awesome video of our son bringing in the groceries, and I'm like, it's your time, it's your part. And he's like singing while he's trying to push the Sam's Club sized boxes, pushing them through the door. Poor little dude. So I felt so heartsick about this because it was so beautifully done. I thought, oh no, it's like too beautifully done. Like, it's over. This is it. They're not going to do a season 3. I mean, they are wrapping this up.
I hope not. I know.
I really hope not.
I think he was just hedging just in case.
One thing that I like, that the idea that like wrapping up season 2 cleanly as one can, I suppose, because we really don't know everything yet about Murphy's and everything, or what the heck's happening to this town. In terms of our Garvey family, I mean, I feel like it's pretty, you know, They're wrapping it. So I do respect the fact that they come to a resting point at the end of a season. And, you know, if this does have to be the end, then at least I feel like we did get some satisfaction out of it. But at the end of the song, he does close his eyes, and true to his word, Bridgeman sends him back.
And this, again, reminded me of, like I mentioned in the 8th episode's podcast of the movie Constantine, which, if you saw that movie, the reason he uses water to go between the mortal plane and hell is because if you don't use water, he says, it hurts like hell. And that's why you use a bathtub, a bucket, whatever the case. In International Assassin, he comes in through the bathtub, right? And then he goes out through the well, and he's okay.
Right, right.
So in this, he comes in through the bathtub, but he goes out through nothing, just through the karaoke stage. And he wakes up
hurting.
Yeah. So I'm going to go with the Constantine theory on that
one. We're going to keep water around if we're going to be doing this.
If we need to jump to the hotel, we're going to need some water up in here.
Right?
Yeah. Keep the bathtub full.
Nice. We will do that.
Wakes up in the kennel and someone has come in, seen his dead body and been like, you know what? I'm just going to let all the dogs out and leave him there.
How weird was that?
Pretty weird.
God, these GR are so messed up. I feel confident it was a GR person. But his poochamooch
stayed.
He stuck by his side. Man, how emotional was it when Kevin's like bawling and kissing on his dog and saying, thank you for waiting for me. Is that like, oh, tear?
And he finds that the bullet has passed straight through him.
Yeah. Do you know that part where he was shot? Do you remember when Nora was having the prostitute shooter and she made such a big deal about where? Like below the heart, right here, shoot me like right here.
Yeah.
That's like right where Kevin shot. So I don't know. I guess this is like a sweet spot kind of situation.
He goes outside with the dog and he finds the area has deteriorated somewhat from the last time that he saw
it. Holy crap. Everything's on fire. The Jarden sign is completely tipped over. And
the dog kind of gets away from him. The dog is like, I need you to follow me over here.
So you took it that the dog was trying to get him to follow him to the Airstream?
Yeah, that's what I got.
Okay, so
and
not
Kevin's like,
away.
I've been shot and I'm still kind of, even though I'm alive, I don't know how. And I'm bleeding and I hurt. So I need to find another human. So I'm going to do that. So the dog's like, okay, I'm going to go that way anyway. So he goes toward the Airstream where we know friends are.
Theory, yeah. Tommy and Nora and Lily are there.
But Kevin goes into the welcome center where it is trashed and the loop of the girl saying the welcome center spiel.
She's like, welcome.
Yes.
I was like, ah.
Here's another 80s reference. Totally Max Headroom.
Oh, it totally was Max Headroom.
Yes.
Yeah, you're right.
And he finds a hive of GR in there.
He does.
Just hanging around. They've been trashing the town all day and they are tuckered out.
Is that how you take it? Like that they were laying around like that? Because, I mean, they had been out in the encampment. So in theory, I guess they could have been kind of dehydrated and, you know, sort of just really, really like, you know,
no,
maybe,
I think they've had a long day.
Yeah. No,
trashing the joint.
That's true. And I guess partially too, if you think about it, like if you're like amped up for like the big thing, there's like that big like let down, you know, like adrenaline is all out of your system. Everybody's just going to kind of lay down.
The big plan worked. I mean, I had my prediction about the girls hanging themselves and you said, well, that'll be dramatic, but it won't cause like this big black eye. That won't give them like this big thing to associate.
It won't ruin the town.
Right. And this isn't as emotionally dramatic per se, but it definitely
They've taken over the town, you know?
And that took quite a bit of doing.
It's not even a scar on the town, Paul. Like, I don't even know where the townspeople are. Like, I mean, they are taking it over.
Well, this is Texas, and this is just like the first night.
Well, what he means by that is that John Murphy was an oddity that he only had one gun in the house.
Right.
So
that's just his toolbox gun.
Just his toolbox gun. Right. That's his traveling gun, really.
Right. That's just for the gun you need when you're fixing stuff, really.
Right. For when something goes a little awry. Yeah, no, I'm with you. When you need an extra hole and you just can shoot one. Why would you drill it when you could shoot a hole through it?
Right. Right. So he goes in and he sees Meg surrounded by followers and Evie not very far off.
He's like, what are you guys doing here?
And she just says, well, what are you doing here? And his response is what gives me some hope that season 3 would take place again here in Texas. He says, I live here now.
Yeah.
He didn't say anything
like,
very
come and take it.
He didn't say anything very wishy-washy about it.
That's true. He wasn't like, I think I might head to Australia.
Right.
Or he Brazil or
says,
something.
He says, I live here now.
Do you think it's like, I live here now?
There are three things that lead me to what I hope happens next season.
Okay.
This is the second thing.
Okay.
Do you want me to just go there now or get to the third thing and then go there?
I'm going to take your lead, Paul.
When we get to the third thing, then
you're going to unleash.
I'll unleash it. Yes. Okay. So Meg, in as psychotic a look as she could put on her face, starts to sing the town's song. And Evie, who's normally the soloist, starts singing this barfomatic bass line.
It sounded so bad. She was like, like in the background.
The walkers from the Walking Dead sound more appealing than that bass line sounded.
Yeah, no, they wrecked that song hardcore, and it was gross. And I felt like Kevin just like shook his head. Like I felt like I was having a Chief Garvey moment when he was kind of like, are you guys smoking pot in the park? Like, get out of here. Like, what are you doing? You know, like I felt like he was just shaking his head at all of them. Like, you have a bunch of loons. Like, goddamn.
So he's like, I'm clearly not going to find anyone to help me with my gunshot wound here. So
right. Good call.
I'm going to go. This next thing that he does.
He didn't say anything like, y'all got a medic within the GR ranks?
He goes outside and there's a fallen park ranger on the ground and he grabs his nightstick. Now, this is the third thing that gives me my hope. Like if I was a fan fiction writer, this is where I would go.
You know where you're going?
Yeah.
I can feel where you're going now.
He puts on his cop suit, right?
When he was in the hotel, right?
He's cast off Patty, so he can think right again.
True, fact.
So he puts on his cop suit. He tells Meg, I live here now, and he picks up the nightstick. To me, this is Wyatt Earp in Tombstone.
Yeah,
right?
No, I agree. I totally felt you. As soon as you said that this is the third thing, I was like, oh, he's going full on taking sheriff.
This is a town
sheriff
without a lawman. And he's a lawman without a town.
No, you're exactly. That could be the motto. Damn, that's season three. This town is without a lawman. And this is a lawman without a town, man. This is like a marriage made in heaven, right? A marriage made in Texas, I would say, right? Because there is some sheriffing that needs to be done. He needs to get some constables all up in there, right? To show these people are talking to National Guard. I'm like, oh, you're so sweet. No, sweetie. We got sheriff's departments, my friend. We can bring some good old boys over from Louisiana and show them what's going on around here. Who are you going to run from? No one's running from the National Guard.
Right. Well,
they could go put some sandbags down over by the encampment.
We actually do have Texas Rangers.
Yeah, peeps. This is a little more serious in our state. I would love for them to bring out some Rangers and kick some dupe, right?
Well, they only send one. It's like an old rule from the cowboy days. It's one riot, one Ranger.
Oh, my God.
That's how badass they are. Anyway.
It's not Chuck Norris, is it?
It might be Walker, Texas Ranger, actually.
Would you love it?
So.
Would you be like, oh, my God, is that Chuck Norris and Jordan?
Kevin,
he's all like, Jordan down.
He's like 72.
Oh my God, but he's beautiful. Stop it.
So Kevin, although he has his nightstick, he is in no shape to knock heads. He just needs it just in case anyone needs their head knocked in his immediate zone.
Right. He's like, I'm going to be doing this with the stick. If you come near me, you're going to get whomped.
Note that Caroline is making a head whomping motion with
and
her
a
arm.
Simpsons reference.
Yes.
Damn it.
He gets his way to Erica's urgent care, where he breaks in. And
really, he just kind of walks in, dude.
Well, whatever.
But nobody's at work. Nobody's at work. Nobody felt that, you know, all that crap like, oh, during a riot and the medical people heard the call and they all came to work voluntarily. Guess what? No one freaking came to work in Jordan Town.
Yeah, the riot is all taking place around the tower where Turk Pipkin's character takes up residence.
Right, so he's basically like looking down on them like, y'all's a bunch of loonies tonight. I'm trying to get some sleep here under my little tattered robe. And y'all are all making some noise. And are those people humping doggy style over there?
I think they were.
I feel like he's going to like spray a water bottle at them like, no! No, no, no.
Right.
Do you think that's the indicator that this is like Sodom and Gomorrah? Like, that's it?
That's a pretty literal way to look at it. Yeah.
I mean, doggy style in the town center. Who the frick does that?
So Kevin is trying to find...
It's not even GR, Paul. What is that?
That's animalistic.
It's... Oh, Paul.
So Kevin is trying to find gauze and any kind of thing that might help patch him up.
For some reason, I had this idea in my mind that there's some sort of gauze, something where it's like you could stick it in a hole and it like... I don't know. Like you leave
you don't,
it
You
there.
Don't need to keep going. I don't know. I mean, I don't know anything about that kind of medicine kind of thing.
I don't know. I thought there was something you could put, like if you had like a gunshot wound or something, you could like
yeah, you like burn it closed. That's what I know.
No, you can't burn that mess closed.
Yeah, you cauterize it so you don't bleed out.
No, that's for other things. You can't hit the hole straight through, friend.
But Kevin is in bad shape.
You're going to want to pack that shit, Paul. That's what I'm saying. You're not going to cauterize. You're going to pack that wound. Damn it. Don't be in charge of me when I get shot. Please.
And he's on the floor when another voice comes into the building.
Hold up, Jesus. Hold up. He did not just go to the floor. He leaned his back against the wall and blood slid like down the wall. That was so much blood. So much blood. He had like a skid mark of blood down the wall.
A familiar voice comes in yelling for Erica. John sees Kevin leaning against his blood slick on the wall. And he says, I killed you. And Kevin.
In the best writing in all of television.
Nope.
That was awesome. I love Kev. And that was like such a good delivery, right?
It is perfect.
So
John is like, well,
now he's like doing like this.
It's like, well, if I didn't kill you, I might as well help you. So he starts trying to clean the wound.
That's not it. It's that he realizes Kevin didn't have shit to do with his daughter. And he was completely telling the truth. She did fake her disappearance. She went with the GR. So, I mean, it's not, he wasn't just like, oh, sorry about that gunshot. I mean, he was like, I was freaking dead wrong, right? I mean, the story's unfolded now. Kevin didn't do jack.
And go on with your religious reference as well. And he pulls up his shirt and there's
well, this
the
was a
wound.
Little...
We have a resurrected man here in front of us.
Right.
Twice resurrected.
So you guys know the Doubting Thomas kind of biz where he doesn't believe that Jesus really was resurrected. And I'm not going to say this exactly right, but it's basically the idea that like, you know, Jesus says, you know, like stick your finger in my palms. Like you can see like the nail marks, like you put your hand in my side and all that kind of stuff. You can see all the various wounds. And Doubting Thomas, disgustingly, needs to stick his fingers into Jesus's wounds to really believe. So that's the deal. It seemed a little out of place for John to want to stick his two fingers, like, gooping into a gunshot wound. Like, that seemed a little weird. But I got it. Like, I mean, if there's plenty of pictures that you can see of Doubting Thomas, like...
But he had to.
Shoving his fingers
he
in.
He had to. And then he cracks.
He's that freaking stubborn.
He cracks, though.
Can't let it go.
And he says, I don't understand what's happening.
And you know what? That's what I mean about the kind of stuff about where the writers have them say what we all think in our private minds. Because that character didn't have to say that. I mean, he could have just been like, he could have said 1,000 things, but it, like, that is real. It really is like, what the what?
And Kevin admits, even though he's gone through this whole thing with Patty, and Patty killed herself in front of him, and then rode him around like a spirit monkey.
Spirit backpack.
He says, me neither. I don't get it either. And then the song of the season starts playing. The Pixies on the piano starts playing to represent mental trauma.
Oh, both of these men are just beside themselves at this point. There are no answers. This is just such a freaking mess.
But at least they're together. At this point, you know, they're opposite sides of that coin, but they're at the same point, the same time.
Well, it's funny, though, to be totally fair, and especially to keep making these Lost references. I mean, it's not that Kevin's a man of faith. I mean, he really isn't the opposite side of John. You know, I mean, he's not. Matt might be, but John's not. You know, they're not the opposites. But in this moment, the experiences that Kevin's had versus the experiences that John's had. Their experiences are very opposite, right? Is that make it
well,
Kevin, more fair?
Kevin has no choice but to believe what he has gone through.
I don't know if he's what he had to go through it. So
that's
I'm not
true.
Saying, I mean, he's not
I mean,
going around
yeah.
telling everybody, like,
he's,
hey,
he's
everybody,
a cop. He,
don't
he
worry.
Wouldn't believe this if someone just told it
yeah,
to him.
Yeah, and he's not going around trying to tell people that this is the way. You know, he's not going around being like, hey, everybody, good news. You know, you just got to do karaoke on the other side and you'll be all, come on back. So, like, if he was doing that, then I'd say, oh, he's a man of faith. But he's not. He has had life experiences. That's what makes this biz real. He's not a hot talker. He just, this is what's happened. This is his story. So their bromance blossoms.
And John helps get him home, walking down the street. He drops him in front of Kevin's house. John is scared. He says, what if no one's home at my house?
I thought this was incredibly sweet and so vulnerable, so raw, you know, because that is his greatest fear. And to be honest, who would be at home? Who would be there? How would this work out? You know, what's going to happen? Even if someone is physically in the house, he doesn't have a wife anymore. He doesn't, you know what I mean?
He yeah.
They're all gone anyway. But Kevin answers.
You come to my house.
Oh, you guys. That's so cute, right? But isn't that all anybody wants, Paul? Like, in all honesty, don't you just want to know that if something goes wrong over here, I can just go to your house and it'll be okay?
Yeah.
That's kind of like everything, right?
So John makes his way home and they kind of reenact their wave from John's front porch down to Kevin's front walk, the wave that they had in the first and second episodes. They reenact it, but this time at night.
But they do the same exact thing. They wave.
John waves first. Kevin waves back. John goes inside. And we don't know his fate at this point.
We don't. But what we do know is that Kevin takes one step and earthquake happens again.
He's knocked to the ground.
So what do we think? What do we think? We've been talking about how, you know, are earthquakes all about one person moving from one realm to another? If it happens when Mary comes to and it happens when Kevin comes out of the ground, if all these things are happening, then what? Does this mean that something's happened to someone else? Or is something happening to Kevin? What's going on?
We know in Damon's shows that he likes to treat us respectfully by following the rules that he sets forth in his own shows. But that doesn't mean that he tells us all of the rules.
Very true.
He gives us enough clues that we should be able to assume the rules and be right most of the time. However, with the earthquakes, I don't know that we have enough to go on. Right now, we're assuming that there's a supernatural association with the earthquakes, but we don't know which one to draw the best conclusion to. Is it the coming and going?
I really think it's the coming. I'm putting my money is on there's an earthquake when there's a coming and going. I think it's some sort of like with all your talk about portals and sort of the ground sort of like cracking open, thinking of all these things. I feel like it is either the movement between either someone's coming or going from this realm. Like, that's what I think is happening.
It's funny. Why don't they just get like a seismologist out there and see if the actual plates are moving or something? See if there's actually like some tectonic stuff going on.
I think after the girls, you would have thought that they would be out there to see because, you know, there was some amount of thought that the girls were somehow sucked down into the hole or something if they'd been out there swimming. You would think that there would be somebody out there with their little Geiger counter being all like, okay, here's what's going on. We got a plate right under here. You know, I mean, something, right? There was a shift or not.
Right.
You know, or not.
Earthquake's over. Kevin's still there. So he picks himself up.
He walks up his front steps and opens the front door.
And everybody's there.
This is another one of these like, oh, my heart is aching.
They stage this shot the same way you would for a finale.
Absolutely. And it also reminded me of like Wizard of Oz when Dorothy wakes up and it's the very end and she's like, and you were there and you were there.
Or the Gilmore Girls finale.
Where, yes, you have to go face to face of each character who had been there. And like, you know, you got Jill. You got Lori. Then we have Matt and Mary smiling together on the couch. Then you have like Tom steps into the room with Lily. And finally you have Nora. And she walks to him and she says, you're home. He just smiles and is crying and smiling at the same time. And that's it. Oh my God. What a beautiful ending. And at the same time was, did I just see an ending? Like, please don't let this be an ending. Please, please, please don't let this series end. I really, really, really applaud them for doing a very wonderful job of a season finale, but please don't let this be the series finale.
I still have relevant, strong questions. I know that they answered what happened to the girls. That was the whole point. Like Damon has pointed out over and over again in these interviews that he's done in magazines and online, that he wanted the second season to have what he called a backbone, similar to how in Breaking Bad, different seasons had the whole point of the show. Like, that's the one when they're in the trailer, not the trailer, but the Winnebago. That's the one when they have like the super lab, and that's the one when they're going from house to house. You know, like, that's the thing. In this season, this was the mystery departure slash thing with Evie. You know, this is right. What happened.
I want to talk more about what do we think of season three? Like, part of the thing is I appreciate that viewers still have questions, but what I think and what I'm like betting my money on too is I still think Damon and Tom have stories to tell. And that's very different than us saying, well, we still have questions. You owe us more story. I say, no, they have more story. There's more there. This is so rich in human experiences that I feel like there's a lot there, you know, that can still be talked about. Meg is such a crazy character. You know, there's got to be stuff that goes on with her. You know, we never even got one moment of story for Turk Pipkin up there, the Our Pillar Man. Why is he there? What is he doing? Why was he like really the only safe resident in Jardin when this all went down? So I think there's a lot of wonderful, wonderful stories here yet to tell. I don't feel like we have to keep going back to the hotel. I hope that kind of becomes a very rare situation to ever happen again. I feel like that was amazing and an interesting story, but I don't need to hear it again.
Right.
Yes. I especially don't want Kevin to have to go through that again. It would seem awfully
cruel.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of gratuitous, I guess, like to be like, well, he's going to die again. Like, no, please.
Unless he became someone else's guide. They were like done with his character. Like his character had run his arc and they needed him to propel another character. So they needed him to be the Virgil.
I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, it could happen. It could absolutely happen here. I like him becoming the lawman of Jardin. I don't know exactly what happens. I don't know then if we focus more on Jill and Tommy and Lily and, you know, sort of what's going to happen with all that. Some people have talked about maybe a time jump happening, you know, a couple of years passing by so that you could get, you know, everybody sort of at a different juncture. We don't have to see exactly what happened. Although, do you think that when John stepped foot in that house, there's some amount of chance that Erica gave him some, he ate lead, is what I'm trying to say?
No, I bet she just left. I mean, she was ready to go.
That's true. She had her go bag. She had her bindle.
And this Evie thing,
I think it would just rip your heart out. Like, I don't think you could hang around.
I don't think you're going to do a lot of good teaming up with, I mean, if you're Erica, is your path back to feeling good with John after this whole Evie thing happens? I don't think so. Not the way that she's been acting this whole season.
Yeah, I'm with you. Do you think we'll follow both characters, though? Or do you think Regina King's out of the story? Or is there like a reverse? Like where Lori was in and Jill joined? Is it possible that Evie's in, so Erica will join?
Even though we didn't get a whole lot of John's POV, we did get more. It seemed like we were meant to care more about what John was thinking and feeling and doing and going through for some reason. It all got back to what John was doing and his motivations and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So
do you think that there will we focus more on the women now? Will we? I mean, because we didn't get a lot of, like we said, Jill, Nora, Lily, Lori, Erica. Like, are we going to direction?
Actually, I don't. I mean, We both read that article where the tease at the end was suggesting that Scott Glenn come back, Kevin Garvey Sr.
Right, right.
The analogy that Damon used was that Scott Glenn's character, Kevin Garvey Sr., is a starting pitcher that we've been using as a reliever.
So, yeah, so that does absolutely say there's a whole lot of story to be told, which honestly, there was a whole lot of story that
as like a lead.
Well, yeah, and there was a whole lot of story that we brought up, too, that, like, you know, we could definitely see Kevin and stuff in flashbacks with that whole story because we were like, where is Mrs. Garvey, like, Senior's wife? Where was the mother there? Like, we talked a lot about, like, what was the relationship between Senior Kevin and Matt Jameson? And what was the relationship between Kevin Senior, Matt Jameson, and Mary? Like, there seemed to be a lot of weird stuff, you know?
You could do a lot.
Lori would barely seem to know who Matt and Mary were, yet we knew they were so close to the Garveys.
I think you could do a lot without getting in danger of going back to the bleak Mapleton tone of the first season.
Right.
But you could...
are rich characters that, you're right, we're just not... We haven't even scratched the surface on a lot of them.
Yeah.
Super exciting. That's so amazing.
The interesting thing about Kevin, for instance, becoming sheriff or something like that, is that it may not actually be that interesting to see him clean up Jarden.
I don't think it would be at all.
But if it was like a footnote on an episode after a time jump, that would be like, oh, yeah, well, that's why everybody loves him, because he cleaned up the town. That'd be like assumed.
I feel like a time jump is super appropriate too, because I feel like Lily's story can't happen until she's like 5, 6, 7 years old, you know? Like, I don't think there's anything interesting for her between the age she is now until she gets to be about, you know, like I said, at least 5, 6, 7, a good age to be able to be showing some weird powers or speaking her little mind or remembering things that she couldn't know or whatever. I don't know. But you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I feel like there's a lot of that kind of stuff that's out there that's, and I don't think that anyone cares anymore about seeing anybody in a high school or, you know, like for Jill or Michael, or like nobody even gives a hoot about their educational world. You know, like it's time to move on. Everybody needs to move on. What is everybody doing a couple of years from now? I think a time jump would be super appropriate. And some of these characters need to have that. Senior needs to have been gone for a little bit. You know, he can't just be like 2 days later and he's back. That seems weird.
But his misadventures told the right way could be very interesting. Like him going crazy, him figuring out how to convince everybody that he's not crazy, and then how he goes to Australia and manages to make contact with Kevin when he's in the hotel. That's not a straightforward thing, right. You know?
Right.
All that stuff would make for pretty good
story. I think it'd be amazing. I'm all for it. I want to know more about David Burton. Some people have said that David Burton is the dude on that there's like the bridge master guy, and that's like, Turk Pipkin might be writing a letter to him and that kind of crap because, you know, maybe. But I don't know. It doesn't make sense because he seems like he lives at the hotel. Bridgeman lives at the hotel, like lives in that realm, I'm trying to say. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that's what people are saying. I think we have not met David Burton. I don't think we've scratched the surface of that storyline. Or, like I said, Turk Pipkin, who is a very well-known actor and has been, you know, in a lot of great things. And we didn't even get to hear him say one word. Or maybe we did, like,
who's your friend?
Here's my letter. You know, right. Like that kind of stuff. But I mean, I want to know, Turk, I want to hear your story, man. I want to know what's going on with you.
So, listeners, that's about it for the finale. We still have episodes outstanding for the first season, episodes 9 and 10. We are interested in doing our National Geographic review. And we have a couple other ideas that we're kicking around for more content in the coming weeks.
If you guys have a show that you would like to recommend to us, we really encourage you to hit us up on Twitter at Daily Review or on our Facebook page, Daily Review, or website, dailyreview.com. We are looking for that next show. We've heard Fargo is an amazing ride, and that looks interesting to us.
But, we have Netflix, we have Hulu.
We'd love to hear what you guys are into and what you'd like to hear us talk about. It has been an amazing 2 seasons with you guys, and we certainly hope we get season 3. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.